Deb Thieler served over 4 years for conspiracy to traffic meth. Today, she's an addiction recovery RN and says going to prison was the best thing that could have happened to her. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll talk with Deb Thieler this hour as we conclude our summer correction series with a look at recidivism. We'll examine why former offenders from rural areas may be at a disadvantage when they leave prison and what factors influence an offender's likelihood to return to prison. We'll also examine how former inmates find employment after serving time. Keeping offenders from going back to prison after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And this hour, we conclude our corrections series that's been running this entire summer up to now with a look at recidivism. We'll examine a little later why former offenders from rural areas may be at a disadvantage when they leave prison and what factors influence an offender's likelihood to return to prison. We'll also examine how former inmates find employment after prison. It's one of the most difficult hurdles offenders face after serving time. But overall, it turns out that Iowa does well when compared to the rest of the country in terms of recidivism, according to a 2011 Pew study that looked at recidivism rates from 41 states during the period of 2004 to 2007. Iowa's recidivism rate was 33.9%, about 34%. The national average was something over 43%. So during the course of the hour, we'll find out why. Joining us, first of all, Jesse Goodwin is a former inmate. He is someone who has reoffended several times and is now a volunteer and advocate for current and former inmates. Jesse Goodwin joins us from Des Moines. Good afternoon to you, Jesse.
How's it going?
Pretty well. Let's first find out how long have you been out of prison?
Just over 3 years.
Okay. When was the first time you went to prison? How old were you, and what year was that?
I don't know. I think I was 19.
19. What sent you behind bars the first time?
It was a drug charges.
Mm-hmm. So, how long were you there on that first charge?
Probably about, I think, 7 to 8 months.
7 to 8 months, mm-hmm. and you got out. What was your? Do you remember your thinking when you got out about the likelihood of reoffending?
Yeah, I guess I just kind of thought it was part of the lifestyle I was living, and I really didn't think about whether I was going to go back or stay or not. You know, I was just going to continue living the way I was.
So that experience, that first time in prison, didn't change your mind about what your lifestyle would be like, how it would be different once you got out?
No, I don't think it did. I think only thing it did probably was bring out some more lies that I told people that I cared about what I was going to do, but I had no intentions of doing anything different.
Lies, for instance, about what?
I'll never do it again. I'll never go back. I'll take care of my family, those type of things.
Mm-hmm. You weren't convincing yourself at all?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. What, yeah.
You know, one thing that it did do, for me anyway, was that it boosted my ego a little bit and made me, when I came out, you know, the guys I was hanging around, then I was a tough guy and I was in prison and I didn't tell them that I was at a minimum camp to start out with. You know, I was a tough guy in prison and had got out is what my story was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably harmed me more.
Mm-hmm. Did you get back into more or less the same crowd?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it boosted your status. That's interesting. So how did you get into prison the second time?
It was actually a violent deal. We were drinking and had kicked somebody's door in.
Mm-hmm.
I got it pled down to a charge of burglary, which is, you know, I guess what we had made a deal on. But originally, it was a violent crime.
How much prison time did you serve for that?
3 years total.
3 years. Any change in those 3 years going on in your mind?
You know, I thought about changing, and I'd went through a couple small programs to do stuff like that. Same time, I was still I would drink a little bit when I could. It wasn't very readily accessible where I was.
In prison, where were you?
At that time, I was in Fort Dodge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Help us understand how someone is able to drink, do drugs in prison?
Well, there it was, you know, guys would try and make hooch. You know, I mentioned before about I used quite a bit of heroin while I was in prison. That wasn't in the state of Iowa. That was in a federal prison. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I guess it's always the same story. Either a guard brings it in or a visit, you know. It's always the same story, unfortunately.
So in your second offense, you spent 3 years in prison. Mm-hmm. That time getting out, what do you remember thinking?
I was thinking I was pretty upset. Actually, I'd left from the hole. I discharged my sentence from the hole.
From the hole?
Solitary confinement, I guess.
So how much of your time did you spend there?
Just the last 3 months of that. I mean, I was in and out a few different times for various things, anger issues, you know, and fighting. When I left Fort Dodge, I left from solitary confinement. I got out. I was out exactly, I think it was 59 or 60 days, and I got caught for firearms and got – so then I was federally indicted.
So 60 days, some 60 days after leaving prison, you're – caught again. Were you pretty much from day one after walking out of that prison and solitary confinement up to activities that were going to lead you to get caught?
Yeah, I started drinking and smoking weed, I guess. And then about 53 days after I was out, I started doing more drugs. And 7 days after that, I got a federal indictment.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like really substance abuse is at the basis of your problem.
Absolutely.
Time through.
Everything I've ever done has been chemically induced.
Mm-hmm. Take us in the third time during prison. How long did you spend?
I don't know. They gave me 100 months, and I guess I got out 8 months early off of that. So.
Okay. And that was just a few years ago that you got out.
Yes, sir.
Anything different about that time serving?
You know, when I first got there, it was the same thing. I was the same person, and only there was more drugs and there was alcohol available. And I stayed that way for the majority of my sentence, about 6.5 years. And then I don't know what it was. One day I just got sick and I was hurting, and I just said I was done. And I quit smoking cigarettes, and then a little bit later I quit doing heroin and I quit drinking.
Was it the influence of a fellow inmate, a fellow offender, or was it the intervention of a program in prison?
I think it was just I was done. You know, I wanted to change my life, and I didn't know how to do it. And then I was fortunate enough to be able to get transferred my last couple of years to a facility, a medium security facility, that had a rehabilitation program. It was a 500-hour RDAP. It was a rational thought behavior program.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jesse Goodwin, how old of a man are you?
I'm 36.
You're 36. You've got a good bit of life ahead of you. You speak at youthful offender panels, persuading young offenders to change their ways. I want to ask you about that in a minute. But first of all, I want to add to our conversation Tristan Potratz, a correctional counselor at the Iowa Correctional Institute for Women in Mitchellville. Hi, Tristan.
Hi.
Tristan joining us from our Des Moines studio as well. You work at Mitchellville's Patient Substance Abuse Program, I understand. It's a several-month treatment program that not only addresses substance abuse, but the underlying causes of them to drive to abuse alcohol and drugs. And we've heard Jesse's story here. Tell us a little bit about do you know each other, first of all, Tristan?
Yes, actually, we were just talking about that. He was on my caseload when I worked at Fort Dodge.
Okay. So you are one of the counselors that works in the program, a program that Jesse also used. And I understand a big part of that program is something called cognitive restructuring. I kept asking Jesse what changed or what didn't change. And so you are working on restructuring thinking. How do you go about that?
We have a number of programs that we have in our inpatient substance abuse program, like moving on, helping women recover, a lot of gender-specific programming that talks not only about their substance abuse but also about the underlying issues that go with that, whether it's trauma, abuse, or things like that.
When we hear Jesse's story, how many Jessies are there out there, or have there been out there? Is that a typical story, so much reoffense?
Yeah, it is very typical.
And when you listen to his story, what do you see in it from your perspective as a correctional counselor? What didn't happen and hopefully finally did happen?
Well, I think that part of it is they've got to want it. They've got to want to do something different for themselves. And if they're not ready for that, we can't force that onto them. When they get ready and start opening their mind to a different way of thinking and behaving in society, we try to help them with that as much as we can.
You deal in thinking errors.
Yes, thinking errors.
Thinking errors. What are thinking errors? Give me an example.
An example of a thinking error would be something like victim stance, where they see themselves as a victim instead of seeing themselves as somebody that's created the environment that they're in, that they can make better choices for themselves, but they're choosing not to.
Mm-hmm. Jesse, is that the way you thought about yourself a good deal of the time?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. What was your story? Give me your pitch to people when bad things would happen to you. Oh, back in prison again.
Yeah. Well, I always thought everything was somebody else's fault, you know. And then, you know, and I mentioned before I'm in recovery. I try and do a lot of things in recovery in the community of Des Moines. And I would always blame my problems on the drugs and alcohol. And I always thought that maybe that was the problem, that it wasn't actually Jesse. Mm. And I didn't realize that once I removed those issues from my life that I could start working on the real issue, which was me and my thought process.
Was there a moment, was there a time when you realized it wasn't the alcohol, the drug abuse, that it was Jesse, that you cut out that middleman?
I did. It was probably about 2 years after I was sober.
Mm-hmm. Was it in a conversation, or do you remember a moment?
Yeah, it was in a conversation, actually with a counselor, and that was one of the guys that was teaching the thought behavior process, and you know, and even when I wasn't drinking, I would still react in situations that I was ashamed of, and I would think, why am I doing this? Because I've removed the problem, and I didn't realize the problem was that I had to take action and steps in order to correct my thought process.
Mm-hmm. Tristan Potratz, why do people who end up in prison have such an abundance of these type of thinking errors? What's going on? What can we say about the science of how people get to this stage?
That's a tough question, because there's a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds that we have. Whether they grew up in that environment. I had a girl on my caseload that was doing drugs with her mom at the age of 10, and she was raised in an environment that promoted that kind of criminal conduct. And then we have other people that have pro-social families that don't have very good coping skills, that will choose to do things that hurt them more than help them.
So what I hear you saying, we can't really know if it's nature or nurture here.
Yeah, we're not really sure. I think it's probably a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm. Back to these thinking errors. I understand that in the groups, you do an exercise that often gets people to have an aha moment. Would you describe what you do? In terms of having people share one of their specific thinking errors?
Oh, criminal conduct and substance abuse. One of the assignments that they do is they have to actually identify their own thinking error, what they feel is their biggest thinking error. And then we also have the group give them what they feel their thinking error is. And they sometimes are not in agreement with that, but it helps them to see outside of themselves and maybe something else that they're missing.
At least it sees what image they're projecting,
yes,
even if they don't feel it. And if there's a mismatch, then is there usually probably an astonished look in some cases?
Yes, yes. Sometimes they get defensive. They get angry about it because they don't see it. And then after that emotion settles down, they actually start realizing that maybe that is something that they need to take a look at too.
Mm-hmm. In your recovery, Jesse Goodwin, what was the most difficult part of that after the recognition? Getting rid of old thinking habits?
Yeah, pushing pride and ego out of the way is probably my biggest deal, you know. Mm-hmm. And touch on something Trish was talking about was a good friend of mine always says, you can't fix the problem with the brain that created the problem. Sometimes you have to have somebody else tell you what the problem is. And you know, sometimes you take it with a grain of salt, and sometimes you probably better listen and take some action.
Right. And it sounds like just because you recognize, oh, I'm in a thinking rut, my wheel is stuck in a rut, I'm going down the same path, Jesse, with my thinking, because you recognize it doesn't mean you can get that wheel out of that rut so easily, does it?
Correct.
What about from the counselor's perspective, Tristan, the most difficult part for you?
As far as what?
Well, as far as what hurdles do you see again that you find challenging when it comes to helping these people?
Well, when they first initially come into our program, we do the stages of change model, and they're usually in the pre-contemplation or contemplation stage, which means they either don't see that they have a problem and they are okay with the lifestyle that they're currently living, or they think they might have a problem, but they don't really know if they want to do anything about it or what they can do about it. That's one of the hardest things, is to get them from that pre-contemplation to more of the action stage, where they're actively doing things differently and practicing that new behavior.
If you've just joined us, my guests are Tristan Potratz, a correctional counselor at the Iowa Correctional Institute for Women in Mitchellville. Jesse Goodwin with us, a former inmate. He's reoffended several times, been out for 3 years. It sounds like something like a decade you've spent behind bars. You're only in your mid-30s. Jesse, about a decade, is that right?
Yep.
Okay. And let's continue with you and have a couple of others join our conversation. There are several risk factors that influence whether an offender walks out of prison for good or one day returns to that correctional system. Now, states like, including Iowa, make significant investments in treatment programs with the goal of reducing the rate of recidivism. My next two guests are researchers at Iowa State University. I think they're going to tell us that investment pays off. Andy Hostetler and his co-investigator, David Peters, recently completed a study comparing rural to urban recidivism rates. Andy Hostetler is a professor of sociology at Iowa State University. David Peters, assistant professor of sociology there as well, and extension rural sociologist at ISU. Andy, David, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Okay, you're in our Ames studio. Your study compared urban to rural parolees. Tell us what you looked at specifically. What did you want to find out?
Yeah, this is Dave Peters. Our study was funded by the National Institute of Justice, and what we did is we partnered with the Iowa Department of Corrections to try to understand whether their investment in a treatment and risk assessment system actually paid off. And so the state of Iowa over the past several years has done a very extensive job at assessing risks from the moment they enter the criminal justice system, identifying what their most highest priority needs are, and then trying to get treatment for those offenders in their highest needs. And so part of the grant was to try to determine whether or not that system and that investment paid off. And as you mentioned, we found that statewide it did, that we found completing a treatment for their first or second highest priority need had a significant reduction in the odds, reducing the odds of that offender returning to prison. And it was the second strongest predictor. It reduced the odds by about 38%.
Mm-hmm.
So very strong. Though the wrinkle in this is when we looked at it between urban offenders and rural offenders, we found that treatment effect only really applied to urban offenders, and specifically it was alcohol and drug treatment. So the other guests have mentioned that alcohol and drug programs have discussed that, and that is consistent with what our research found, is that treatment works for urban offenders, and it's primarily alcohol and drug treatment that drives that effect.
Okay, so what is the difference when we get to a rural setting?
The rule setting is very interesting. What we found is that treatment has no effect. No matter what treatment they do, it has no effect at reducing recidivism. And actually what we find statistically is that it actually tends to increase the odds of them ending up back in prison.
Now, that seems to make no sense. I don't know if your study covered an explanation, but what do you think?
Well, we're still investigating it, but what we found is that the treatment that tends to drive rural parolees back into prison is completing an education or employment program. And what we found that the profile of these rural parolees engaging in these education and employment programs, they tend to be unmarried, very young, and they're at high risk for not using their time in a socially appropriate ways. And so what we think is that given that they're young, they're male, they don't use their time very well, and they're located in rural areas where there's not a lot of outlets for pro-social behavior, we think that that tends to drive them to get into trouble.
Mm, okay, so perhaps fewer alternative choices, fewer alternative paths to take than the one that they were already on before they offended.
That's right. So one explanation would be that they're paroled back to their home community. They pick up old habits, old associates, and they try to stay on the straight and narrow. And given the lack of other other individuals to engage in, the lack of other types of organizations or other social activities to engage in, eventually they tend to fall back into patterns that ended them in prison in the first place.
Mm-hmm. How much of the last part of your explanation here is backed up by science, or do you need to do some follow-up studies?
Well, we do need to do some follow-up studies. So we have a finding, which I mentioned, that we found that treatment actually has an effect at increasing recidivism, but we don't have an explanation.
Okay.
And so that's what we're trying to find out why that is in particular. Now, one of, course, the issues with our study is the other guests have mentioned that we find that treatment, we're looking at broad statistical effects. And we also did a follow-up in the study where we talked to individual probation and parole officers, and we do know that there's individual variation. And so how parolees and the probation and parole officer interact are very individual. It's very individualized, and we're looking at sort of broad patterns. But we hope to find, even though each case is individual and individual-specific, we hope to find some broader patterns that help, that can influence state policy.
Okay. And so when we come back, I want to ask you about a Pew study. It looks like Iowa is doing very well in terms overall compared to other states in its recidivism rate, according to a 2011 Pew study, which looked at those rates for 41 states between 2004 and 2007. Iowa's recidivism rate, about 34%. The national average, 9% higher than that. So quickly, let's go into it after the break. But what's the quick answer as to why Iowa is doing so much better? Do you know that there in Ames, Andy or David?
Sure. This is
Dave.
Andy.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we found that rural offenders had less recidivism than do urban offenders, but we also found that treatment was not effective for them. And so, you know, if you're assuming that Iowa is a more rural place, therefore we should have
We should. We'll get back to that answer in just a moment. We're talking with Andy Hostetler, a professor of sociology at Iowa State University. David Peters, also of Iowa State University, a fascinating study. As we talk about recidivism on the last installment of our correction series we've been running this summer, also with us, Tristan Potratz, a correctional counselor at the Iowa Correctional Institute for Women in Mitchellville. And Jesse Goodwin, a former inmate, reoffended several times. Now he's trying to teach others how not to reoffend. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at the role of juries in the American judicial system, their origins. We'll learn how juries have evolved over the centuries and also examine the recent flourish of media attention aimed at jurors who sat for the George Zimmerman murder trial tomorrow on this program. Today, we're concluding our corrections series. It's been running this summer up to now with a look at recidivism today, looking at, for instance, why former offenders from rural areas may be at a disadvantage when they leave prison. Also, overall, what factors influence an offender's likelihood to return to prison? We have with us Jesse Goodwin, a former inmate, He's reoffended several times, been out of prison now for 3 years. Now he's a volunteer and an advocate for current and former inmates. Tristan Potratz is with us, a correctional counselor at the Iowa Correctional Institute for Women. That's in Mitchellville. Andy Hostetler, he is a professor of sociology at Iowa State University. And David Peters. Dave is an assistant professor of sociology and extension rural sociologist at Iowa State University. Let's talk a little bit more about the studies you've been conducting, Andy and Dave. Specifically, when we talk about a rural setting, someone who has been an offender and is out, what are the differences between a rural and urban setting in terms of resources available to that parolee?
Yeah, this is Dave Peters, and when we've done our analysis, what we found is there's a couple factors that we think are barriers to rural parolees successfully completing their parole. First is just the distances involved. And so most rural communities in Iowa are isolated in terms of population, in terms of their geography. So it's a longer drive to get services. Oftentimes, there's lack of availability of services. This is particularly a problem with mental health services. In fact, in some judicial districts which administer the community corrections in Iowa, there may be only one or two providers of mental health in an entire 10-county district. So availability is very an issue with mental health. Lack of employment opportunities in the region and transportation needs to get to those jobs. So parolees that parole to rural areas, oftentimes they may have a stipulation they can't drive as part of their parole agreement, and so that makes it very difficult to get to their services, attend treatment, and obtain a job.
Mm-hmm. Even though Iowa is doing very good compared to other states, even though it is a rural state, what can Iowa do to even lower these recidivism rates even more?
Well, one option would be to intensify the treatments they get in prison. It's a controlled setting. They're available. They can attend treatments more readily. And so while there's a push to parole more individuals to free up space in the prison system, there is an advantage, particularly for rural parolees, to do either to keep them in prison or to move them to some sort of controlled setting, a halfway house or some sort of intermediate stage, that they're able to complete treatment and they have access to treatment. And so keeping them in a more controlled setting for longer, particularly for rural parolees, and having that access to treatment and access to providers would be beneficial.
I understand that as part of this study, you interviewed some 30 rural parole officers in your study. What did they have to say?
They said almost unanimously that mental health issues are a problem. Finding providers, getting scheduling, scheduling treatments, that seems to be the major issue for a lot of the more rural community correction districts in the state.
Mm-hmm. Did they indicate whether this was a problem newer in origin or it's a problem that's always been there?
It's a problem that's always been there. And they're particularly interested in how the new mental health redesign that's going on in the state of Iowa, how that might impact the corrections, community corrections.
Mm-hmm. What are the hopes there that you heard from these parole officers?
Well, they hope that it will make services more consistently available across most areas of Iowa, and so that would be a positive thing. If there's more access and more availability of mental health services in some of these smaller, relatively limited resource counties.
Okay. Also joining our conversation, I want to introduce Deb Thieler is in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
Great to have you joining our program here. You are an addiction recovery RN, but you are also a former inmate. Where did you serve your time?
Mitchellville, ICIW.
Mm-hmm. You were sentenced to 35 years for a conspiracy to traffic methamphetamine.
Yes, that's right.
How long did you actually serve?
52 months.
You have said that going to prison 14 years ago was the best thing that could have happened to you. Why?
Well, the main reason is because I was the first group of what Ms. Protraz was talking about, the therapeutic community, the drug treatment program there. And so I actually got an intense treatment program. And with due to the length of my sentence, I was able to stay in the therapeutic community for the whole time I was incarcerated, mm-hmm. Both working and as a member of the community.
So, Tristan, had Deb been had her offense gone to prison earlier, this would not have been there for her or in the form that it was.
Right.
Okay. So when did that come into being in this form?
I believe it was in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So good timing for you, Deb Thieler.
Yeah, if you want to look at it like that.
If you want to look at it that way. So what was that like going to prison? You say it was the best thing that could have happened to you. What led you to getting involved with meth, not only a user but a dealer?
I think it goes back to the thinking errors and my thinking. My thinking error, my personal thinking error I found out while I was in treatment is pride, and it's still pride. And my pride, I got to the point where through divorce and other circumstances in my life, I didn't want to give up my lifestyle. I didn't want to give up living in a nice home, living in a nice area. And when I found myself divorced, I could not afford to maintain that lifestyle. And due to my pride, I, instead of putting a for sale sign in the front yard and leaving that area, my thinking said, well, maybe I would be good at selling drugs. Mm-hmm. And that way I could afford to pay my bills and maintain my lifestyle, which that to me today now is completely twisted. My freedom is way worth way more than my house.
Mm-hmm. So that thinking error also occurring that you could deal in meth and then become a user at one point, and you were an exception. You were not going to have the typical downfall.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm. You to be clear, you were an RN before you went to prison, right?
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So how did that fit into becoming a meth addict and user?
How did that fit in?
Yes. Did that – I mean, you – as an RN, you know all about drugs.
Oh, yes, I do. And I know a lot of addicted medical professionals. And I think that I thought that I was different than everybody else because I was educated. My family, the family that I came from, was a upper middle class family. No one in my family had ever been in trouble before. I actually maybe even thought I was above the law and I would never get caught. I mean, I never even thought about a prison. I didn't know where the prisons were until I landed there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think most people do.
Mm-hmm.
They
don't think about the consequences.
Nope.
When you were convicted, you lost your ability to practice as an RN?
Actually, no. I had put my license in an active status. I had several back surgeries back in the 80s. And due to my medical needs, I had put my license in the inactive status. And so it was there. I just wasn't practicing. And when I was paroled, I'm blessed to this very day. I can't tell you how blessed I am that I had people on my side. The Board of Nursing here in the state of Iowa was totally understanding, more than willing to give me another chance. And even told me at one point that they needed more people in the nursing profession that were in recovery to give other nurses and doctors the incentive to be clean and sober.
As we mentioned, you served 51 months of a 35-year sentence for conspiracy to traffic methamphetamine. 52 months. well, most of your time in prison was spent in that rehabilitation unit. What was that like? What was going on there that made it so effective for you, Deb Thieler?
Okay. I was hired by the institution to become the first mentor for the program. And learning to mentor people, I learned what those people had gone through, what their I heard many, many women's life stories. I realized that my life was not near what other people's lives had been.
What do you mean by that in terms of?
As far as women that had endured multiple years of trauma and abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, which I had none of. And it just made me more grateful for being able to recognize that I had blessings and I needed to be grateful mm-hmm. for those things.
And you have, because you could be an addiction recovery RN, you had a new passion. You had a new calling, didn't you?
I did. Mm-hmm. I did. And I still do.
All right. Now, how long have you been out of prison?
I've been out since 2003, so 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel the threat, the danger of engaging in the activities that put you there?
Myself?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely not. No. I have surrounded myself with positive people. I have positive family. My children are a huge support. And no, I know that there's people that I can call, that there's other women that I have actually gone through the program with that are still out clean and sober, that would call me on any kind of thinking that I had that was twisted. No, I don't. My sobriety comes first every day, mm-hmm. before my family, before my children.
And you talk about it with your family, with your children. It's not something that you keep in the dark.
No, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what was that like to readapt to the outside after more than four years in prison? Was that a difficulty, Deb Thieler?
You know, I just want everybody to know one thing, that it's harder to leave prison and come out of prison than it is to go to prison.
Why?
Because you come out and it's a life that is not, I mean, it's like landing on another planet. You don't have a, quote, home yet. You have not established, and I don't know if it's more for women than men, because women tend to have nesting tendencies. And when you come out of prison, you're wherever the parole board sent you. You've lost your home. Many women have lost their children, which I, again, am grateful that my children were right there when I got out. However, just walking out of the prison where you know there's people there that support you, there's your treatment program, you don't know your parole officer. It's just like starting a whole new life and building a whole new village, I guess.
James is on the line calling from Des Moines. James, you were in on this conversation. You have a particular perspective. What do you want to say?
Well, I do. And what is the unsaid elephant in the room is that the primary focus of anybody who's incarcerated is surviving. We cannot guarantee the safety of the people that we incarcerate, and that makes them have to concentrate on that rather than changing their behavior and getting into a program. And your first guest got it right. Until you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, you're not going to profit from any treatment program they have.
Mm-hmm. That was Jesse Goodwin, who is still with us. Jesse, what are your thoughts as you've heard this conversation and James' comment there?
You know, I just, until you're ready to change, you're not going to change. You know, as far as James's comment, you know, I appreciate it. However, when I was at Leavenworth, you know, when I first got there about my third day, I said, oh, my goodness, I'm not that tough and I'm in the wrong place. And I seen some things that I wouldn't want anybody to have to go through. Was I scared? Yes. Was I scared to change my life? No. You know, I was probably more scared to continue living the way I was because it was going to keep me in a place like that.
Tristan Potratz, what do you have to say as a counselor, correction counselor at the Iowa Correctional Institute for Women in Mitchellville about James's comment? Is it as simple as that or more complex?
Our hands are tied because we don't have the staffing that we would like to have to do all of the great things we want to do. So, you know, I understand where he's coming from. We don't have the staffing for that. But I think as far as what Jesse said, I think it's right on. You know, he was ready to change, and that's basically the bottom line of the whole story.
James, thank you for your call from Des Moines. Let's make sure we include it before the hour ends. Irina Horn is with us in our Des Moines studio as well, community program monitor for the 5th Judicial District. Irina, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Now, I understand you help offenders adjust to life after prison, including finding appropriate employment. We don't have much time left, but you work with federal clients, clients you call them, the offenders who have been released. As someone who helps offenders find employment after prison, what are some of the barriers they need to overcome so that we can understand, you know, getting that employment, how important that is? What are the barriers?
Employment is very important. The barriers depend on how long the individual was incarcerated and how they can adapt back into society, because depending on if someone was, you know, incarcerated for 2 years versus 18, like she said, it's walking back into the unknown, and it's helping them redevelop some of the things that redevelop into society.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine the first step that you take is just to ascertain where they are. You can have a guess if they're 10 or 20 years behind bars, how far they are behind, how much society, the tools you need to have a job are, right?
Yes, sir. I meet with each one individually and kind of get some background to help them pull those the assets that they have and help them recognize those and develop a plan for where they're going to start looking for jobs. And
mm-hmm. Do you actually help them acquire new skills, update their skills?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on if, you know, their public law or if their BOP, we do a transition course, which allows each of them to talk about the barriers that they're having.
Mm-hmm. When I think back about, we can all think about what kind of computers were we using 10 years ago, or cell phones, and, you know, no such thing as a smartphone 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I imagine that can be a shock.
It is, and that's the biggest thing is the technology is their biggest barrier.
Right.
Coming out and some of them have never seen a cell phone and trying to help them learn how to use those. We don't have a lot of time to work with them individually, but giving them resources out in the community to connect with the support person to help them develop some of those skills that they're lacking.
Mm-hmm. What sorts of work do your clients end up finding?
A lot of them are labor jobs.
Mm-hmm. Labor jobs, construction?
Yes, sir.
Other types of – what other sectors that their former inmates are likely to find?
A lot of them, you know, landscaping, roofing, but they're grateful for whatever they can get. And I always tell them that we're always looking for that opportunity, not for the person who's not going to tell you no, but the person that will tell you yes and give you that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. How important is attitude of someone coming out? You can judge an attitude probably in a very short conversation. What are green flags and red flags for you?
You know, it's each one is so different. But a lot of times it's just the excitement is for me is their red flag, because some of them are so excited to get back and learn, and then they're rushing into it, and then they get overwhelmed, and it's just trying to get them to learn how to pace themselves and take it one step at a time instead of trying to take on the whole world as soon as they get out.
Jesse Goodwin, let's get back to you quickly before we have to end the hour. You speak at numerous youthful offender panels to persuade young offenders to change their ways. What are the main messages you want to drive home when you speak before very young people? It could have been, you know, you sitting in that audience years ago. What do you want to get across?
The thing I try to focus on is the solutions to my problems, you know, and that's doing things like that, the volunteer work, staying connected with the community. I like to tell with the younger guys, I usually start off with, this is what I did, and they get real interested, and then they say, well, that's not what's important. Is what's important is what we're doing today, you know, and that's where the change is taking place. And, you know, and I've been really fortunate and blessed financially and spiritually, and I like to share those things, let them know that they can have it starting out where they're at now, and they don't have to wait, you know, 33 years before they start getting it.
I imagine you get some tough nuts to crack in there, just as you would have been at that age.
Sure. You get a lot of people that they're too tough to listen, and then you get a few that actually call you, you know, a year or two later and tell you they're still doing all right.
Mm-hmm. Jesse, I asked Deb about this. How worried are you about reoffending as someone who has offended three times and been sent to prison for it?
Well, just like Deb said, I'm not concerned about it. You know, I know that if I keep doing what I'm doing today, and number one in my sobriety comes first, you know, if I can continue doing that, then I can continue doing the things I'm doing today. You know, and one thing I want to say is I work with a lot. I work with men. I don't really work with women. I'm a man, so I know what I can do. And
you work in construction.
I do, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have to go in just a minute, but I understand, Jesse, you just got married?
I did.
You did. Well, congratulations.
Thank
How
you.
Long ago?
June 8th.
Okay, so that helps you, your support network, family. How do you feel about your future?
Fantastic, and it's getting better.
Jesse Goodwin, that's great to hear from you. I want to thank you all for being with us. Irina Horn, Jesse Goodwin, Tristan Potratz, Deb Thieler, and also our professors from ISU, Andy Hostetler and David Peters. Thank you for giving us a lot of insights this hour to chew over. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, help from Garrett Van Leeuwen. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about the role of juries, their origins, and we'll learn how juries have evolved over the centuries. Also talk about the George Zimmerman murder trial next time on River to River.